Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Good morning. Today we are talking about work. We're going to dive deep here. So, Mike, I was actually just reading a recent statistic talking about 50% or so of Americans are dissatisfied with their jobs. What do you make of that? Like, you know, I think there's a lot to maybe some reasons why, but what do you make of that, and what would you have to say about that?
Well, I've read some of the same statistics, and obviously it should bother us. I know some people have low expectations and think, you know, the point is just get a job, get a good job, make a decent living, be able to do the American dream, buy a home and have three kids and what have you. But unfortunately, job takes up a good chunk of your week, 168 hours in a week, and a lot of people work 50 plus, maybe even 60 hours. That's not a great way to go through life, that the majority of it is called a job. So we'll have some fun here, since you use that word, and I hadn't thought of this for a while, but do you know what the word job means?
I do not.
It means criminal activity.
A bank job.
And so robbery. So it came out of the Industrial Revolution. So this is fascinating to think about for a moment. You've heard about cottage industries. Why were they called a cottage industry?
I just guess because they're smaller. Small scale?
Smaller, yes. And also because prior to the Industrial Revolution, the home was the economic engine of the developed world. And so you worked out of your home. And then with the opening of what John Mills called the dark satanic mills, these sooty, filthy, you can imagine England and coal dust in the air and dark, men went off to work. And left the home throughout the day, and it was called a job. I've got a job. And it's just fascinating to think. Now, let's not present a picture of life as all like Downton Abbey or something like that. 3/4 of the world's population worked in servitude or some kind of slavery in the year 1800. So work was toil. And that's fascinating, that when Adam and Eve fell, God pronounces oracles. Oracles are the consequences. It's almost like Neo visiting the oracle. And she was sort of telling him the way it's going to be from this point on. And God said, from this point on, two things are going to happen. It's fascinating that he says, first of all, your pain to the woman, your pain in childbirth is going to increase. Now, we could spend a whole lot of time on that, Pat, on two points. First is no husband should ever say to her wife when she's giving birth, I feel your pain. We just don't know what that's about.
Fortunately, I did not make that mistake.
That's pretty good. And the second, though, is that, and actually three things now that I think about it. Second, that tells you there was pain in childbirth before we fell.
Right.
A lot of people feel that, you know, in the garden, there was no pain. And in fact, there was, because he said, I'm going to increase your pain in childbirth. Third, that word pain is the same word that he uses when he pronounces the oracle against the man. And he said, your work is now going to be toil. And toil is a four-letter word. It's where we get the idea even of a job. And so work was supposed to be something that was deeply satisfying. It might be, I know you work out, Pat. It might be something where, you go to the gym and man, you bust your butt, but you come away and go, dang, that felt good. I feel good. And that's what work was supposed to be. So with the fall, it became toil. And so today, most of the language we use reflects exactly what God pronounced was going to happen, that it was going to be a job. And it was going to be much more difficult to find satisfaction. And you speed the film up, much more difficult to find deep joy, because most people work and they never see the fruit of their labors as they would have had we never fallen. There was, there in the garden, they could pick and mix and improve. And all work is today to try to meet some sort of need in society. But the fact of the matter is, if you sit in front of a screen all day writing code, it's just hard to go home and say, hey, honey, let me tell you what I did. It was a fascinating day. Now, you might find code fascinating, but, and I know you do, but for the rest of us, we're clueless how you write a million lines of code and make it all work. It's just very hard to imagine. And so a lot of people, the dissatisfaction is there's still a lot of people stuck in cubicles, call centers, pulling shots at a coffee bar, and most of the efforts to make that meaningful really fall short.
Yeah, so a couple things come to mind with that. One is sort of this celebration of Friday and the dread of Monday. I think another example of just how our distorted view of work has developed. And that's it's just disappointing how we think that going through life, like you said, with the majority of our life being something we put up with is tough. But I think in the Christian realm, but well, I would say two points. One, in the Christian realm, I've had a lot of conversations around sort of a missing sense of calling, or really just not sure what God wants me to do with my life, you know. And I think that's a valuable pursuit, but often can end in a feeling of disappointment and not really knowing where I'm supposed to go. But then even within sort of my generation, I think a really good heartfelt sense of I want to do something good for the world. And what that can lead to is unfortunately a sense of dissatisfaction for things like sitting and writing code for 4 hours and not really knowing, well, how does that make the world better? Or punching numbers into an Excel sheet. And just feeling this dissatisfaction because I'm not immediately helping the world. So how do you make sense of that?
Well, first of all, I'm encouraged that there are some encouraging signs of people wanting to do work that is meaningful and is satisfying and does make the world a better place and is actually good for the environment. That is what I commend the Business Roundtable. 181 of their 188 members voted that passed a new mission statement, which is much broader. They're going to take in more than just shareholder return, but other considerations for their people and profitability that also is purposeful and takes on into account the planet. Now, there are a lot of people who are cynical about that. I always remember Oscar Wilde's definition of a cynic. Someone who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. And so it's easy to be a cynic and or arch your brow in suspicion, will this actually work? But the fact of the matter is there is a stirring, and some of it because of social media, to say, I want this to make a difference. And I just think that the trick's going to be that I think you've got some hard, stubborn facts in this thing called calling that we've got to come to terms with. Well, let me tell you what I mean by that. So in my generation, there was a beginning of some people who began to write about calling, and they were mostly in a vocational ministry. And while their intents were good and the content is good, they really don't have much dirt under their fingernails for what it's like to go work, for example, where you work at. And for all their good intentions, I think the lion's share of what my generation has written comes off as fluff. It's not really taken seriously by serious businesses. And so I think that's a challenge right there. But the upside is what you're talking about is we could stand for some more voices from the actual business world talking about business as a calling, which it ought to be. And but too many of them that write about it, they don't work in a business. So it's kind of like nice work if you can get it. They get to write books about it. And I think that's one of the dangers of what's happened over the last 500 years with the Enlightenment is people that are writing about things that they have no actual experience in. And that's the French word concept. When you start writing about concepts, it shares the same root as the word conceit. The conceit is you're describing something that you have never put your hands on or really worked at. And so you can write about principles. And again, principle is just kind of an Enlightenment term. In principle, Thomas Jefferson, who was an Enlightenment man, was opposed to slavery. And when he died, he had over 100 slaves. He wrote eloquently against debt in principle, yet he died deeply in debt. So I think we would be more served by having actually people like you write some short books on how in heaven's name and what you do, do you find a sense of calling in this, a vocation?
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll work on that. So, I mean, how do you define calling?
Yes. Well, I mean, that's pretty easy. It's when you think of the word vocal, the Latin word is vocation. So calling, I think, implies a caller. And so that's the challenge in a post-Christian world is you can't have a calling without a caller. So I think part of the move back to I'm spiritual but not religious is that sort of opens and widens the lens to there's something or some spirit or some something out there that calls me. Now, the challenge in this is that caller used to be considered to be the triune God, the God of Judaism and Christianity, the God that we understand is one nature shared by three persons, Father, Son, Spirit, and they call, let us make them in our image. That's the first calling right there. I think the challenge right now, Pat, is one of the challenges, rather, is I don't know how you have a calling if you don't have a caller. And if the caller isn't an actual person, then where does this call, this voice, vocatio, emanate from?
Sure.
So I also think and Dallas Willard wrote a good book on this many, many years ago, and I can't recall the title right now, but he also took into account that the majority of Christians out there would say they're really hazy on what this thing is calling, what that's about, and is this my calling, and when did I hear this calling? And so even though my institute is named after the work of these activists in England that were led by the likes of people like William Wilberforce, who had a calling and recorded it in his diary. He felt God had placed upon him two great callings, the abolition of the English slave trade and the reformation of culture, or manners, he called it. And that animated his entire life. So I think a calling is essential, I think that even when we fell, you have God calling out to Adam and Eve. Calling is essential, but today for most believers, it's very hazy, often rather fluffy, and not doesn't really have any wheels on it. I mean, what does that mean that you feel called to that, and how is that being fleshed out in the work you do? And then it's the your generation and even Gen Z, upwards of 80% that might be religious nuns. How do you even translate that into the wider world where they're warm to spirituality, but the idea that work should be a calling, and calling comes from God, and because God does speak and interact with us, and they go, well, yeah, no, I'm not interested in that God. I tried that a long time ago. No, thanks.
Yeah, for sure. Well, one of the things that I think started to shed light for me on what may be calling and discovering calling, and I by no means have figured that out, but I think it has given me a glimpse of insight into what it'd be, was sort of talking through the word avodah and beginning to go down that path of what does Scripture have to say about work? In the four chapter gospel, I think the beauty is we see it all the way back into creation. You see it with Adam. You see him naming the animals. You see him working in the garden. So there's definitely a sense that there is something to work that is good. And I think that's where I was for a while, was I knew work was good. I didn't really understand why work was good. I didn't understand what is it about work that is so unique. Until Avodah started to come into play. So, can you share some?
Sure.
I don't know how you want to intro it, but however you want. Let's talk through Avodah a little bit.
Yeah. Well, we can do it the way we just did it last week. We had some operators. We had 10 operators from Charleston, South Carolina, for the actually Chick-fil-A, the number 3 fast food in the industry. Fast food provider. So I threw up on a big whiteboard. If you can imagine this, listeners, you can do this at home. It's safe. I wrote these words: work, worship, ministry, service, and the arts. So again, work, then worship, then service, then ministry, and then the arts or craftsmanship. Put these words, I arranged them in a big circle, and I said, now the paper in front of you, I want you to draw the first image or what the first thing you imagine when you see or hear the word work, and then go over here to worship, and the first thing again that you imagine, just draw it real quick. And then we went down to ministry, same thing, service, same thing, and the arts. Just again, the first thing you imagine. Don't self-edit. Don't go, what's this guy trying to do here? And they fired away. And I said, you got 1 minute. Go, draw. And they did. And then they showed us their pictures. And the pictures were all fine. Work often at keyboard. Now, with Chick-fil-A, it turned out to be a chicken sandwich. And worship was hands raised and music. And service was maybe, housing project and service there, actually, because this was Chick-fil-A, to them, reaching across and handing over a burger. I'm sorry, oh, there's a mistake, a burger. I'm now out of that organization. And then I forget what they drew at the arts, but here's the point. I said, you know, it's funny, these are all good and suitable pictures, but when I said draw 5 pictures, I didn't say draw 5 different pictures. And in fact, you could have drawn 1 for all 5. And so in the middle of my, on the big whiteboard, I could have drawn anything, Pat, really anything. But I just drew a Chick-fil-A sandwich. Then I went up to the word work, and I said, there is a word in the Hebrew, avodah, A-V-O-D-A-H, avodah. And it's first rendered or translated in Genesis as work. It's in Genesis chapter 2. God rested from the work, avodah, he did. He completed the work, avodah, he had done, so on and so forth. Thus, at work, avoda is rendered as work. But if you read on in the New Testament, I'm sorry, Old Testament, you'll see that it's rendered as worship. And if you read on, you'll see that it's rendered as ministry. Then later on, it's translated as service. And later on, it's translated as the arts or craftsmanship. And so what I did is I drew a big circle to show these words all are translated from one word in Hebrew, avodah. I said, ask them, so why is this? Is God tongue-tied? Is he a millennial with limited vocabulary? And they, I noticed they were pulling out their iPhones, taking a picture of the whiteboard. And I said, let me tell you what's going on here. The Hebrew word tom means integral. It's where we get our word integer or one. And when God created the universe, it's one God who created one universe that rotates one way. Put another way, he didn't wake up on Thursday morning and say, now today we're going to make secular stuff. And so if God created all things and all things hold together, there's a seamlessness to the entirety of creation. In fact, there is no Hebrew word integrate. And so I said that God never wants us to integrate faith and work, for example. He wants us to discover the integral, seamless nature between work and worship and service and ministry and the arts or the aesthetic. So I said, so here we go. We do work because God works. God is a worker. We work. And the old English word where we get our word worship is worth-ship. That is, if you do our work as it ought to be done, that's worship. And you're right, Pat, that is a mind blower for a lot of people to think that when you go to work, no matter what it is that you do, Luther would say, other than prostitution and slave and banking, if you do what you ought to do, that's worship. Not only that, but we work to improve upon the world. God said after creating a sustainable planet, he plunks Adam and Eve in a garden, and he basically says, make it better. Improve on it. And that's how we serve one another, is improving, meeting needs in the world and improving and making them more effective, more efficient, all those things. And that is how we minister to people. So you can still see this idea of service and ministry in, for example, England, where you have the departments that serve defense and housing, what have you. They're called ministry, the ministry of. And the chief civil servant in England is the prime minister. And then finally, I asked him to look around the room, and we were in our institute here, and I asked them, take a look at this room. Now, we were in a... we use a dining room / conference room of a home built in 1881. So we're talking 12-foot ceilings, and beautiful. And I asked them, how much of this is really necessary? I mean, do you have to have crown molding? No. Do you have to have paint? No. Why do we do this? Well, it enhances the joy of work, to put it quite frankly. And then I had him look out the windows, and I said, look at all these colors out there. Did God have to create color? No. Could have been a monochromatic universe. Did he have to create all these variations of trees, thousands of types of trees? No. We could have photosynthesis, which is one type tree. What is God getting at here? What God's getting at is he wants us to really love work, and the love takes in the craftsmanship and the beauty of it and the aesthetic sense. And so he created a world that just is rich with aesthetic sensory experience, what we taste and touch and feel and see, and what we breathe in. And so this room that we're in is really comes out of this idea in Genesis that work is also to beautify the world And so work is worship, is service, is ministry and craftsmanship. Now, in closing, Pat, on this, or just the next thing I did is I pulled out another color marker pen and said, most people, most Christians, let's say, imagine these five words in three different spheres. First, they imagine work is 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, 8 to 6, 8 to 7. Heck, company you work for, we have friends that work there that it never ends. I mean, they're on calls at 11:30 at night with Asia. And so it's not even 9 to 5 anymore, but it's work. Worship, service, and ministry all get lumped into one sphere. I drew a circle around all of them and said, this is what you do on the weekends or in the weeknight. And then over here, I circled the arts and said, I once had a CEO said to me, well, that's for people with orange hair.
All right.
What you have, in other words, is he ran a medical device company, and his point was, you know, we don't have anything to do with the arts. That's for people with orange hair. That's for starving people. And then when he goes to church or gets in a small group, that's his faith. And then over here, work, that's just, you know, what you grind through. And that's why I think it's going to upset some of our listeners, perhaps, but I think we're seriously off base when we talk about integrating faith and work. It almost makes the assumption that God didn't create them to be seamless, and in fact, that they are seamless. Because if they are seamless, Pat, it's a lot like just taking an old dusty piece of a chest you find in an attic, and you go simply go up there and go, and you blow the dust off and you go, oh my gosh, look at this beautiful woodwork. Look at this.
Yeah, Mike, I remember the first time you mentioned that to me, we were talking about the integrating faith and work. And you said something along the lines of, you can't integrate something that's already together. It's already one thing. And even then it was a classic, you know, it kind of went over my head and I was thinking about it later and it finally made sense where, what you're talking about is there is already a not even a connection. There's already in its own nature, work already is integrated with our faith. It's already connected to the faith story we believe in. And so what we can do is rediscover that nature.
And to have some fun with you, Pat, you just said something that wasn't true because you said it's already integrated. It is already integrated. It was never separated. It was
never separated, right? Right. Yep.
No, it's never been separated. Then, yes, that's why if you just think one God, one planet rotates one way, that's why I say God doesn't wake up on Thursday and say, "Now I'm going to make the faith stuff here, the spiritual stuff, and then the next day we're going to make the secular stuff, and then here we go, Father, Son, and Spirit, we're going to integrate them."
Yeah, so what, I mean, going back the last couple of conversations we've had, we've talked through my day, I show up at work. Mm-hmm. Why is today any different? If I understand Avodah and I see that there is no integration because faith and work already are hand in hand, they're already one thing together.
Yeah.
What does today look like that's different than yesterday if today's the first time I've heard this?
Yes. Well, today is different in that I would urge you to do a little exercise when you get out of your car. If you're, say, a believer and listening to this, get out of your car before you do something embarrassing at work. But just do this. Go, hold up your work with your hands before the Lord and go and start to blow all the mountain of dust that's off it that is blurred or hidden what's already there. And begin to ask the Lord this. Well, how ought I to work today? Because that would be worship. If I actually discovered how what I'm doing and doing it the way it ought to be done as unto the Lord and so on and so forth, there's a lot of verses on this. Just to see if you can recover or redeem a sense of work as worship. this is my worship to you, Lord. What I'm doing, I do for an audience of one. I want you to be pleased with this. Now, again, if you're involved in something, this is where Luther said, all work is holy. And actually, other traditions have said the same thing. Luther said that, except for prostitution and banking. So he didn't feel money should be lent at interest. I get it. So I'm fine with those two. So if you're listening to this, if you are a male gigolo or prostitute, yeah, I'm not asking you to hold that up and ask the Lord, how can I do this as I ought to do it? But I think you have to sit there. I think it's just mind-blowing to go, and you'd also have to start with this. Pat, wherever you are at your work today, God is fully present. And this is why I don't like silly language, like God really showed up. No, I'm sorry. God doesn't show up. That has the implication he was far away, that he's down in Houston this morning, and then he showed up at your work. He is present. And he's present in the entirety of creation. And so if you ask him, show me how I ought to be doing this. And a lot of times it's just do it with great diligence. Do it better than the people next to you, as an example of how you really put your heart and soul in this. And you go, well, it's a calling. It's a calling. I think in some ways we can make the world a better place through the work we're doing here. Then it can become service to other people, and it become a ministry rather than, oh, yeah, this is a platform for ministry. So I'm getting to all these people so I can get them to go to church with me, or I can get them to go. I mean, those are all laudable and noble, and I certainly do that, but it's not because I see work as a platform. Because when it's a platform, then you're making your work utilitarian. That is, it serves a purpose other than the work itself. And I liken it to your neighbor moving in, and you say, we want them to know Jesus. That's fantastic. So you say, so we're going to go take a plate of cookies, and we're going to use this welcome wagon plate of cookies as a platform to get them to invite them to church. No. Now that's called bait and switch. It's where you turn the cookies into something that should be avodah, and you turn it into a platform, something utilitarian to get people to come hear about Jesus. That denudes the value of simply doing work well done, doing it the way it ought to be. That's not worship.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I was just listening to, or I'm sorry, reading a book, and it was talking through diligence. And it was talking about the virtue of diligence. And I hadn't really thought of diligence as a virtue, as I'm sure most my age or with my faith background, I don't necessarily think of virtues as stated things. And what was surprising to me was thinking about diligence by itself in the worshipful nature of it. And like you said, I mean, there is that piece of be diligent and worship the Lord through your diligence. Maybe that is what your Monday looks like. Maybe that's what your worship looks like. But I think it's important to realize that is your worship. So we're not gonna. The funny thing I always picture is going to Sunday, and you would never expect someone to dread going to Sunday and just talk about, oh my gosh, here it is, Sunday has arrived again. Can't wait for this service to get out. No way. That wouldn't be acceptable. But we do it on Monday all the time. And if anything, our volume of worship is far greater during the week. The volume of worship we do on the weekend is tiny in comparison to the volume of worship and the opportunities to worship throughout the week. But we dread work. So I agree. I think it's not because like you accurately called out, we need to integrate the two. It's because we failed to discover the beauty of worship and work and service and ministry and how they all are the same thing. So, yeah, I appreciate you speaking on that, Mike. And you mentioned something that I think is valuable we haven't talked about. You mentioned cookies. And there is a sense, yeah, let's stay there for a minute. No, yeah. I mean, there is that sense of what does work look like if you don't have a 9-to-5 job?
Right? Yes, that's right. Because work is paid or unpaid. It's formal or informal. So, yes, we would be wise to widen the lens on what we understand work to be. As so the now my wife's at times when she did not have a paying work. And now she does have a time in her life where she's doing paid work. But the fact of the matter is a whole lot of spouses, one spouse is does not do paid work, but it is work. And it's work to even have a household. It's work to have children. So it's we just even broadening out the sense of work. All the way out to, we see the Lord tell us, even work out your salvation. Work at it. And that touches on your point of diligence. Work at it. And so I'm not paid by the Lord to work out my salvation. That's, you know, that's unpaid work. We should be doing it for the love of it. And so all of us should be, in a way, amateurs. You want to think about it this way, Pat. Amateur comes from the root word amore. And so we should be doing it because we love to do it. That's what calling brings, is you love to do it. We should also be doing it as professionals. And professional in its root comes from the idea you're professing something about the world. Christians ought to be professing that work is a calling, it is worship, it is service, it is ministry. It is takes in the aspects of beautifying the world. And that's what it means to be a professional in its original. And you used to have to be part of a guild to be a professional. So you could be cobblers, and they would form a guild. And that guild was to encourage one another to continue to do this as a calling. Now, I know I'm sounding like I'm some kind of dinosaur to be telling you all this, because it's like, does this guy live in the real world? Yes, I do. I understand the real world today, the quote, unquote, real world. Professional means highly paid doctor, lawyer, dentist, orthodontist, financial planner. They are considered the professionals. And then we have others who simply do trades. And the trades didn't get paid, don't get paid as well, because that denotes, by the way, value. And so it's less valuable. In fact, they had to simply barter and trade their goods because they weren't professionals. I think this is all terrible. And I don't know who will dismantle it, but it's relatively recent in history. And I think it's time we dismantle this, because what it does is just guts the notion for your wife, for a whole lot of women who are at home, which used to be the economic engine, and feel like changing diapers and cleaning up poop and watching cute little Johnny sling the yogurt against the wall. It just is, this is a calling. This is work. This is worship. This is, yes, it is. I'll throw out one more thing too, Pat. I think that this is where, again, social media is not, it can help, but it hasn't for a whole lot of people. We have a crisis in this country, rising depression, suicide, and a lot of it's related to social media. So a lot of it is you're stuck at home with a couple of kids, one's colicky, life's just kind of a bitch. But you can get on your smartphone or TV and look at all these beautiful people doing beautiful things. Whereas prior to the Industrial Revolution, you know, we were rural economies primarily and tradesmen. So in a rural economy, the farmer who's just outside the door of their home, but he's looking at the rear end of a mule all day. I mean, you get home, your wife looks good.
That's great. That's a quote.
It looks like she's got the fun work. And So I know that we are getting into a mishmash of a world of who's a spouse and who's a husband and who's a family and what's a family, and I get it. But again, that, a lot of that goes back to God had us work before we ever fell to further order what he initially ordered, to further it and enhance it and beautify it and improve on it. And this is all so that we will be a prepared bride, up to snuff with our husband. And after the fall, it's like the ball of yarn comes undone, and it just keeps coming undone. I know very well this is harder than Hades in some aspects. And it's where people who talk about vocation and write about it, they would actually perhaps be better served to go sling food at a fast food restaurant for a year and go, yeah, I can see why no one here has ever read my book.
Yeah, two things stood out to me there, Mike. One is, I know you well enough to know kind of what you're saying, but I think some could hear what you're talking about and think you're advocating that we return to a rural agricultural society. And I think what you're saying is technology is incredible, and we've moved forward in so many good ways. And along the way, we've also lost some things. So it's not necessarily saying we need to go back to that lifestyle, but we've lost some things along the way that we did not see coming.
Yes, I'm grateful that the church assisted in the founding of the modern university, modern medicine, understood technologies, things like that. So, yep, it's just that every good thing you do will eventually undo something else. And so do I have an iPhone? Yes. Do I use it? Yes. Am I addicted to it? I don't think so. But the fact is, what hasn't changed, as best we can tell from day one, is there's 168 hours in a week. And if you're spending 3-4 hours of it on a phone, you have robbed Peter to pay that Paul. And that Peter might have been something else, like getting involved in your neighbor, actually walking over and getting to know your neighbor, actually doing something in your city to make it better. Best I can tell, seems to me, when I'm watching people on their iPhones, they're not doing much if anything else. They're standing still. They are sitting. So you're right. I'm not saying let's all go back to walking behind the rear end of a mule all day. But we are in a place where we're in a sedentary world and isolated. It is staggering, the statistics of people who don't know their neighbor.
Yeah.
And yet they do know the price of tea in China because they just Googled it.
Yep. Well, you know
they know it's the color of the earth. So what?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, we're guilty of it too. My wife always yells at me because I love to leave the garage open. Mm-hmm. Every single one of our neighbors, the garage, most of the time, a good 90% of the time, the garage is shut. And I always say, does that look welcoming? Like, not at all, but
it's welcoming to one type of person.
That's right. Someone wants to break in. Yeah.
Maybe a thank you note.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. No, I think you said it well. You said it well. And from our conversation, I think it was two conversations ago, you had mentioned and encouraged me to not do anything in the car, but sit and listen. And you talked about how you actually have a little notepad, and that's sort of some time for you to just have some contemplation there. And I tried that, and it the funny thing is, it's almost like my millennial FOMO, fear of missing out, was actually, I was using that to my benefit, because anytime I wanted to do anything, whether that's turn on a podcast or turn on the radio, even when I wasn't in the car, but I found that desire to look at my phone, I was going, man, if I do that, I actually may miss out on something that God has to reveal to me in just my imagination, in my thoughts. And what's going on there. And it worked really well. And it's been working, and I've actually really enjoyed that's been such a, and I think a great example, such a subtle shift to my day, but my joy has been far greater without being on social media. And that's kind of another area where I've applied that to as well. But without being on social media, without continually filling my brain with stuff, and just sitting and almost letting my brain decompress, letting original thoughts come to mind, it's been awesome.
That's incredible. You made my morning.
good.
Millennial FOMO. I've never heard that before. That's good.
Yep. It's definitely a thing. But this is the first time it's ever actually been useful for me. Yeah.
Well, yeah. You know, actually you raised something that might be helpful for listeners. I would encourage everyone, to begin to practice the discipline, the spiritual discipline of solitude and then silence. And the reason why is solitude, it won't give away the whole game, because when I first began to do it, it blew my mind too, like you were just discovering. And again, most people don't understand the spiritual disciplines are necessary because right at this moment, your habits, your bodily habits, in fact, your very body, physical body, is either an enemy or an ally for you trying to become a holy man. But it's not neutral. It's either right now, its habits are going to drive you away or they're going to drive you closer. I understand for the last 500 years in the Enlightenment West, we feel the key is just train your brain. So more information, think right, act right. That if you think right, you'll act right. There's no evidence that actually works. But instead, what the spiritual disciplines do, I'll summarize them. Solitude is really helpful for you to unplug everything. And when I began, I used to do a mental exercise, an imagination exercise of walking around the room of my life and unplugging everything. For a lot of people, that right there is frightening. You know what? But you know what you'll discover if you actually practice it long enough? First of all, the world kept rotating without you. God doesn't need you, but God is fully present. And when he's fully present, even in solitude, you rejoin the world and you no longer feel that you don't have the fear of being left out, of missing out. Because you missed out on everything and you didn't hear from God. Oh my God, get back in there. The planet's falling apart. The solitude is what I've come to long for because it helps you understand that many times the importance of our presence in something is similar to putting your finger in a bowl of water and then pulling your finger out and noticing the indentation that's left in the water. Yeah, it ain't there. And I often think God, we'd be well served to hear from God saying, you know, Mike, I don't need you. In fact, you'll notice we did fine without your presence in what we were doing while you were gone. That doesn't mean I don't love you. But I just want you to know, you weren't missing out just now. You know what you're really missing out on? And this gets to a point you just made. You're missing out on paying attention to the really important stuff. And that's where silence, the second discipline, once you have mastered solitude, is you begin to learn in silence how much we fill the world with noise. And I never appreciated that, Pat, till I pulled the plug. Because when you come back from silence, you go, OMG, what a cacophony of noise. Now we know, you say, well, so what? What difference, Mike? Well, we happen to know now We've always known. All communication is an interruption of attention. All communication. I'll say that again, because in listening to this right now, or even hearing me go, all communication, I interrupted your attention, whatever you were giving attention to. And we have a very limited bandwidth of what we can consciously pay attention to. So Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, will help you understand that the more noise you have in your life, the busier you are, the more you're paying attention to everything under the sun, ping, email, this, that, that, bing, bing, your neural pathways shallow out. Now, what does that mean? When they are shallow, it means you can't hold a thought for very long. And I happen to have some good friends, for example, and they've done really well in certain industries, mostly in finance, tech, and code and the rest. And their minds move like crackerjacks. I mean, it's just fast, rapid fire. But if you actually ask them to pay attention to be diligent on something, they simply don't have the capacity to do it. There's even some indications that things like ADHD and the rest, they really are cultural phenomenons based on communication overload, based on fear of missing out. And so most of this podcast today, for the average person, they'll say things like, that just went over my head. And it's funny that you have people who maybe had 1 year of schooling for eons, for centuries, and this wasn't over their head at all. But again, it's because a lot of it is, when you're looking at the rear end of a mule all day, you do have a lot of time for solitude and silence. And I don't think God will try to horn in on a very cluttered communication day. And if you don't pull away for silence and solitude, much of what you hear today will never really translate and transform anything you're doing. It'll just be some more interesting information. And I even hear when I listen to people talk, because they talk kind of fast, and they say, you know, that's really fascinating, and I want to learn about this and that. What they're just saying is they're on information overload. Now, you can make a fortune in that on some businesses, but I don't think you can have a well-lived life.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree. Cal Newport has another book called Deep Work that I think is also relevant. It's similar. I don't know if it's a play off of The Shallows, if he's familiar with that book or not. I read Deep Work a couple years ago, and his kind of argument is we are losing the skill necessary to actually do deep work because it is hard for us to focus. And I think he kept it pretty simple, but you know, it's essentially practice is what he was saying. If you practice losing attention over and over again by checking my phone constantly or shifting to a different radio channel, that kind of thing, when you're constantly practicing that, you're going to get good at that. And if you're not practicing moments, periods of deep work where you're actually thinking deeply. He even argues that that's the way our society is going, is that we actually need deep workers. And so if you want to be successful, you need to learn how to do deep work. But as I was reading that book, it was just this constant over and over again, man, like this is Avodah. This is Avodah. This element of deep focused attention, this worshipful time. I don't know if Cal Newport's a believer or not, but it was seeing that and it goes back to what we talked about in previous conversations, which is this isn't a Christian thing we're talking about. This is how God designed the world. We happen to see it align with our faith story, but man, this isn't just to share with other believers. There is deep joy to be found in work that doesn't just have to be an attempt to get someone to come to know Jesus. You can love deeply by sharing this with other non-believers and talking through the joy of work and relating to why they find it important. We're relating to the workaholic. I mean, man, you talk about someone who gets it and probably just a little bit too far there, but
that's not something to look at and say, oh, you need to spend more time with your family. That's something to talk through. Well, what is it about work that drives you? There may be an element that they're chasing there that is good and is pleasing.
Absolutely right, Pat. The like I said, you ought to be leading these podcasts, not me. It's you know, and all the neuroscience is telling us now that individuals in and of themselves are aware of about 5% of what drives their behaviors. So if you are just go, 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 rat-a-tat-tat-tat, traveling here, traveling there, taking this all in, blah, 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 and you don't have any time for silence, you're not going to know yourself. You're not going to be self-aware. The reason for silence, the first time I began to practice it with solitude, I had one morning practicing it, and oh my God, God came up a path that I didn't even know existed in my life, came walking up that path, tapping on the shoulder from the rear, and said, take a look at this. And I went, I'm not even aware, I've never even seen this. That's right. Because individuals only see about 5% of their life. The reason that discipleship used to be done in these Celtic circles or monastic circles is it gave you a 360. And you're exactly right, Pat, in terms of what we talked about today that we'll continue to tease out. All these notions about work and the way God designed them, if you pick them up piecemeal in a rat-a-tat life and then try to rat-a-tat, think about them and blah, 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 they'll never really translate into anything meaningful. Because there's all sorts of stuff going inside of our lives, my life, that blocks that, that causes us to not pay attention to it. And there is no fix for that other than you change your habits. You change your habit over to my habit in driving is it's now listening. And all it's listening for is anything the Lord will say, but it's not listening to a zillion different things.
That's good. I think it's also a good segue. Maybe next week we can talk through habits, what it means to the importance of building habits, but also the sense of spiritual disciplines. Talk through that a little bit. I think that's a valuable piece I've picked up on from a lot of our conversations. I never understood really spiritual disciplines and the role behind them. In a lot of ways, I think people have sort of negative connotations to them, thinking that they're reserved only for the holiest, or they are a discipline, a negative thing, something that I get punished with. So I think that could be really helpful. Maybe we'll save that for next week and continue down that path.
Goody.